Before we get started today, I have a request of you. If you've been a firefighter for more than a year or two, you've undoubtedly been part of a response that went wrong, one where you had an uh-oh moment, but you managed to get out of it somehow, and that's what we're looking for, the story that can teach other firefighters a valuable lesson. After all, you can learn from experience or you can learn from the experience of others, and in this business, the latter is much safer than the former. So let's get that lesson out to the firefighting community. Tell it on the Code 3 podcast with me. Here's an example from Jeremiah King.
I heard a loud pop, didn't know what it was, and then quickly it was followed by several more clear pops in, you know, one right after another. So it was pop, pop, pop. And then the collapse happened. And I will never forget that sound and what it means.
That's from episode 336, titled Last Man Out. If you have a story like that that you'd like to share, just email me. It's scott@code3podcast.com. And let your brothers and sisters in the fire service know how you got out of that jam.
If we go into a building 10 minutes into an incident because we waited for more people to arrive and we find somebody, the decisions you make up to that point are going, you're going to have to live with those for the rest of your life.
This is Code 3, the Firefighters Podcast, hosted by award-winning journalist Scott Orr. Now, here's Scott.
That's right, and I will not let Parkinson stop me. Thank you for joining me today on another edition of Code 3. This is the show that gives you all the information on a firefighting topic you need in about 20 minutes. Let's get started. Firefighters around the country are looking at the possibility of a new OSHA ruling very carefully. I'm talking about the two-in, two-out rule that's contained in NFPA 1500. There's a new report written by five prominent members of the fire service that says two in, two out doesn't make firefighters any safer. Instead, the time wasted waiting for a rec crew to get ready makes it more likely that civilian victims will be killed. The report uses data from Project Mayday to support this claim. It points out that when firefighters die in the line of duty, it isn't usually in a Mayday situation. It also says that if a Mayday is called, it's more likely that another interior crew member will make the save or they'll rescue themselves. The rule is routinely circumvented by departments that need to get inside a building but don't have enough people on the fire ground to do it. An OSHA ruling would add some enforcement teeth to NFPA 1500. The report's titled Removing Two In, Two Out, a Modern Data-Supported Defense of Our Core Mission. It was written by Bill Carey, Sean Duffy, Nick Ledin, Chris Thompson, and Scott Thompson. With me now is Sean Duffy, who's acting as sort of a PIO for the group. Welcome to Code 3.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate you taking the time.
It's good to have you here. Well, the five of you seem to have most of the fire service cheering with this report. What reaction have you seen?
You know, I wasn't sure how it was going to go when we first put out the paper. As with anything, you always, you know, expect some pushback, but, I've been very surprised at how much positive, outlook this has gotten. A lot of people seem to be echoing the same things, you know, and having the same concerns. So I'm happy to see that, you know, and if anything that tells us that, you know, maybe we're finally at a point where we can start logically speaking on this topic.
Yeah. So here's the big question. How often does a rec crew save a firefighter's life?
Oh man. I don't know. I don't have the answer for that, but I can tell you speaking with people who have been part of those Mayday incidents, it's typically not the brand new person that's making that happen. So you know, maybe there's some numbers out there that I haven't seen, but I would think that most of the time, if this is happening, it should be from someone who's actually qualified and trained to do it.
most of the emphasis in this report seems to be on the first few minutes after the first new unit gets on scene. Are you opposed to setting up rec crews once there's plenty of people at the scene?
There's a little misconception, I think, from people who either don't take the time to read this or just kind of skim through it. This was never about saying that RIT was not necessary or having backup crews outside in case an emergency was to happen is not necessary. What we're trying to say is that we have enough conclusive data from well over 12,000 documented Maydays plus other fire science research and things like that to show that, you know, the best thing that we need to do and the safest thing we need to do is have all hands working immediately. So yes, if we could get fire attack underway, search underway with all the people we have immediately, and then backfill that RIT, RIC, IRIT, whatever you want to call it, that would be perfectly fine. And I don't think anybody would have an argument with that.
So what do you think is driving OSHA to change the rule as it's written? I mean, it's been 26 years. Why change it now?
That's a good question. I can't really speak on behalf of OSHA. I wish they would have taken the time to reach out to us and kind of have this discussion. Unfortunately, that's not the case. I don't really know, I guess, would be the answer. But one thing I do know is that 26 years of this experiment, so to call it, has not produced any significant data to show that it's something of value. I think it's caused a lot of confusion. Fire departments are not sure how to operate. You know, there's people that think that this was created for increased staffing when, you know, that's not the case. And OSHA says that's not the case. Maybe this time in the fire service, I think with the proposed changes, if I had to take a stab at it, maybe they're looking at firefighter deaths. You know, there's that 100 firefighters die every year, you know, and there's that scare and people think that a lot of firefighters are dying actually doing the job itself. So whether that be fire attack, search, ventilation, things like that. You break down that and the proof shows that it's cardiac, you know, related or, you know, we're taking our own life or whatever the case is, very small percentage actually has to do with fire ground operations. So I couldn't tell you. Maybe they're putting it into place for a liability reason. I don't really know.
You know, the government will do what the government will do.
That's true.
A lot of engine companies in this country are staffed with 3 or even 2 firefighters. But realistically, you know and I know they're not going to just stand there in the front yard and wait for another rig to get on the scene before they go in. So what's the impact of the proposed OSHA rule?
This new impact, let me say this. Right now, as it stands, before they change anything, there is language in there that specifies, obviously, you can forego your 2 out if you have a reasonable belief that somebody might still be inside, you know. So a lot of people are saying, well, we can always have that belief, right? We could always say this. Well, the problem is now OSHA is proposing to change that language. And that language is basically stating if there is a need for us to enter into a structure, an IDLH atmosphere with an air pack on, the only deviation that we could go from that is if we physically see somebody or there's reports that somebody might be trapped. What that does for us is it handcuffs us because no longer could we have the ability to say, hey, we don't know. We have reasonable belief to think someone's in there. But for them, they've just kind of pigeonholed us into those specific things. And that's a problem. And we could support that with firefighter rescue survey data. Again, over 3,000 actual documented rescues on fire grounds. And what that shows us is that, you know, reports or no reports, nothing's going to change, right? We have fires where people are reported in there and they're out. We have fires where no one's reported and we're finding people. We have fires we show up to and the reports we're given are inaccurate. You know, so really in a time-sensitive, highly emotional situation like that, the best thing that we can do is, as professionals, is think logically, make educated decisions, and put our crews inside to go and confirm this for ourselves, whether someone is or isn't. And I can't speak for everybody in the fire service, but I know that if we go into a building 10 minutes into an incident because we waited for more people to arrive and we find somebody, the decisions you make up to that point are going, you're going to have to live with those for the rest of your life. And I don't know a single firefighter that wants that. You know, I'm sure there's some firefighters or company officers or whoever that might say, you know, they were dead before we got there. There's nothing we could have done or any of this and be fine with that. But the majority of the fire service does not want that. And you start asking those questions and you'll find out that, like, we all took an oath. Our citizens expect it. And there's this quote that we've been kind of talking about as the group. Imagine the possibilities if OSHA trusted the fire departments as much as civilians do. And that's really what we're looking at here is, you know, like, we have an organization that is driving policy that they want to bind us to. We're like almost making it legal binding, and they're not even there, right? How about they focus on the safety aspect of things, right? And let us focus on the tactics that we choose. And what I mean by the safety aspects of things is, like, hey, you know, this is a respiratory standard document. Can we focus on that? That's really its original intent. Why are you putting something in play that's going to affect the decisions people make a year, 2 years, 10 years, whatever from now, when civilians' lives are on the line, right? And that's where I have the problem of it is, you shouldn't be able to dictate to us what our policies are, not necessarily policies, but what our tactics on the fire ground are going to be. You're not firefighters, right? You're not the incident commander, and you're not on that fire ground. So putting this into a canned response, I think, is going to have a lot of negative impact.
Oh, it's impossible to come up with something on paper that fits every situation in the real world. Apparently, this rule is violated more than anyone has accounted for. I mean, the ways it's followed are just wild. One Reddit contributor I saw said they count the crew from their second in engine as the rig, as long as the rig is 5 minutes away or less. That's just not the spirit of the rule.
Yeah. So we were talking about this the other night. The problem is, you know, everything's built on a response, right? So those people that say, oh, well, fire departments have been using two in, two out to justify staffing, I don't know if that's a valid argument, because let's think about it this way. If we have any less than four on a rig showing up, what do we really have? Well, what we have is the incident that could very well occur for most of the United States or any fire department in the world, really, is, hey, I have my first due going to a structure fire. That second due unit may very well be tied up on another call, whether that be a medical, car accident, or whatever it is they're handling. So that leaves the third due. What is the distance from the time the first arriving apparatus gets on scene to when the third is? That could be greater than 5 minutes easily. So to say, oh, our second due, we're going to assist in that, that's great. You have waited and wasted time. And what we know about fires is that they're faster now, right? The modern furnishings, the way buildings are made, like, just, we are not dealing with legacy fires very often anymore. We're dealing with our modern fires, and those are measured in seconds, not minutes. So we literally have seconds to make a decision of what we're going to do. And every minute that we waste, you know, compounds. So I look at things like, okay, American Heart Association, for every minute in cardiac arrest, your survival rate goes down by 7 to 10%. Well, if we show up on scene and we're not putting all available units we have to work, and we wait that 5 to 7 minutes, right? What does that look like for our civilians who are trapped? spin it back on the firefighters. We have all the data from Project Mayday to show that these Maydays are not happening as early into the incident as we want. In fact, they're happening, most of our Maydays are happening 20 to 25 minutes into it, which only further shows that the longer we wait, conditions get worse, the building is weakened more. It's just not productive for anybody to think if we have the ability to put four people in the building immediately, to purposely keep two outside and slow things down.
It's also a PR nightmare because you've got the public standing there going, why are you guys not going in there and saving people? Why are you standing outside? You tell them, well, it's for safety, and they're going to say, but you got all that equipment right on. What's the problem?
Yeah, and I mean, that's a good point right there, Scott, is all that equipment, right? Think about when this respiratory protection standard first came in and the two in, two out, right? We'll just say 26 years as an easy number. That's when the fire department was put into it. The 27 years or so prior to that, that the fire department was exempt from that, we're not going to even look at. 26 years ago, our gear wasn't made the same. We didn't have radios. Our training may have been different, right? Our fires were definitely different. So there's a lot of different things that have happened that now we're in a time where we really owe it to ourselves and the communities we protect to really look at this and say, is this really what's best? Right? Knowing that we do have the ability to go into these fires that we didn't have before, and we have the communication and we have pumps on our fire engine that are going to put out proper, you know, pump pressures on hand lines that are going to be able to hit the fire more effectively, and like all of these things, you would think that we would want to have a conversation on what this really truly does for us, right? Knowing that we have the ability to be way more effective, then maybe we need to make documents and procedures and whatever it is that we're making geared towards our effectiveness, not geared towards making us ineffective.
I found this line in the report to be intriguing. Only 16% of Mayday victims reported that they had confidence in their rig. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I can't speak for everybody. I'm going to tell you this much. Not every firefighter is created equal. Okay, we have a lot of people that get on the job and, you know, they just kind of wing it. Hey, you know, nothing's really happened, so I'm just going to continue down this route. You have training maybe that's not being pushed the way it should be. You have a core group of firefighters, especially now in today's fire service, that are very hard chargers, right? They want the information. They want to train. They understand what they signed up for, and they want to get after it. It is impossible to have a fire department entirely filled of those individuals. So my take on it would be that you just never know who that crew is. Let's say you work for a four station fire department, or maybe you have, you know, you're a one station fire department or volunteer, whatever your system looks like, and you're relying on mutual aid. Can you honestly say that your mutual aid partners train the same way you do? Hell, have you even met your mutual aid partners? Right? Like there's a lot of factors that go into that, whether it be a career volunteer, paid on call, whatever system that is. Relying on those two people outside is a pretty big deal. And if you're not training together, or they don't have the same mindset, right, that they should have, they're not training on writ procedures or anything like that, then it's really just a false sense of security. And again, we talked about this the other night too. In those fire departments that are career and staff, the ones that put their ambulance crews as the writ team, what experience do they have? You know, or do they have the experience in firefighting situations? Do they have the experience in RIT training to be able to fully function in that? And I would like to say that people do, but the reality is more often than not, probably not. You know, those people that we're putting in those positions should be our best firefighters on the fire ground, hands down. That's why fire departments have specialty crews assigned to that task and that task only on fires. And that's what they do. But that's not the reality for most of our fire service, right? So the fact of not knowing who's coming for you is a big deal. And if you don't trust those individuals, then what's the point of even having them outside?
If you did put the medics out there and put them in turnout, you're going to have the same situation where they don't know what's going on inside an interior. And then when it finally fails, when somebody finally makes a fatal mistake because he doesn't know what he's doing in there, then who do you blame? I mean, they weren't prepared for that.
Yeah. Well, and often, I can only speak to experiences that I have and that other people have who I've spoken to. Often those people tend to be your least experienced, the ones that we're putting out, because it's a checkbox, right? All it says is that you need to have two people outside. It doesn't specify the amount of training they need or any of that stuff. So let's do the math, and just think, if most fire departments who hire people who are transporting fire departments put their youngest members on those pieces of apparatus from day one, those are the people that are going to be assigned to that task. Are you really comfortable with somebody who might have 6 months as a firefighter coming to rescue you if you have 20 plus years of experience? It's a lot of trust you're putting into somebody. And I don't think we focus on that enough when we hire and when we train, is that, hey, if this is your role and this is what we're going to have to put you into, then we need to train aggressively, right? And Chief Abbott, when he was doing the Project Mayday, I mean, he's proven that, he proved that it doesn't work based on his research. And the reason it doesn't work to have two in, two out is because typically we have too few people to dedicate to that. They're generally not properly dressed, right? They don't have a RIP bag or proper rescue equipment. Mentally, they're unprepared. They don't generally have a plan, and there's no backup plan, and there's no backup team for if those two were to get activated. So there's a lot going on there that we haven't even addressed, but we have this false sense of security that somehow keeping two people outside is going to be the safest thing for us.
So your report, do you think it's going to have a big impact on OSHA's proposed changes? I mean, you asked for people to vote or to send in public comment. So do you think that public comment's going to do the job?
Well, this is pure speculation on my part. I don't know if there's any facts to this, but I do know that OSHA has extended their public comment period for the second time now, right? So I would like to think that that's because people are saying, hey, this is the first chance in a very long time that we've had to voice our opinions and our concerns. I would like to believe it's because people now we're in a time in the fire service where people ask questions. People are not afraid to stand up for what they think is right. Whereas before it was more as do as I say, not as I do type thing. I think that it's going to have a positive impact. I really do. I think that there's enough firefighters who are fed up with not being heard, who are fed up with organizations speaking for them without them having a say in the situation. And I think it's kind of all come to a head now where people are saying, hey, however this shakes out, whether it's in our favor or not, the best thing we can do, whether you agree or disagree with these proposed changes, is voice your opinion.
All right. Well, we'll have to hope that the influence is what we think it'll be. Sean Duffy, thanks for talking with me today on Code 3.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
And there's a link to the report, which has links to the data sources used, at code3podcast.com/OSHA. OSHA is taking public comments on this until June 21st, 2024. So now is your chance to be heard. The report has all the details on how to do it. All right, that's it. That's all for this edition of Code 3. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next time with more, and I hope you'll join me. I'm Scott Orr, and until then, stay safe.
To contact us, get more information on today's show, or to subscribe to the podcast, go to code3podcast.com.